a lifetime of habits of human relationships must have their fruition. And that the first family can't be the second family. There's a lesson that's been very hard for me to learn, which is the compassion to leave people be and not demand that the first family be the second family. You could certainly see in the first film how the mother's death and the tension, how the son was growing and how the father painfully was growing. And the second film certainly touches that place in us where we get so attached to the structures of our lives and resist so when it all comes into upheaval. And we face the fear of chaos. We want Gramps to be nice Gramps that we always knew, and the growth that comes from coming close to chaos, which illness confronts you with. But spiritually, there is nowhere to stand. And if you cling to cosmos, then you're going to have to be confronted by chaos. We'll be talking as we discuss institutions about the whole matter of infantilizing people, because that's a big one. And you could see that in the movie about Gramps, that even though he became incontinent and his mind became childlike, he was still respected and revered as an elder in the family. And that's such a subtle point right there. Well, in the first film, this man who was still, all he showed us was that he cried once, and that he held on tightly to the mantelpiece, and he was already being treated like a child and could feel it and felt his dignity being stripped away from him. I have more reflections, but what about all of you? Yeah.
I work in a nursing home, and it has been the most extraordinary experience bonding and seeing some of these people who have gone back into their childhood. And I have the passion that I feel for them. I've become one with it. And
I had always had a real problem with my own parents. And when I was much younger, I was sure that if I had ever come up with the occasion where my parents would have to be put away, I would have done it without question. And it was always my biggest bane to work through. But by the grace of God, and that was truly a grace, it just came over me, and we forgave each other totally. I mean, it was really a gift. The love that came out of that grace has changed everything. And today, there's no question that I would do anything for them. And it was also very apparent in that experience that I had that I imagined my mother carrying me over from Europe when they brought me over. And how, you know, what a pain in the ass I must have been for her, mm-hmm. truly, to have to carry me, you know, all the time. And here I am thinking, you know, I have to deal with my mother. It was incredible how ungrateful I was, and the experience was so profound for me to realize all the time she had to get up in the middle of the night for me, and I'm so concerned, you know, that I'm so important that she just took a back seat. Mm. It changed everything. It really did. And being in the nursing home, of course, is really opened me up a lot to the beauty in everybody there. Mm. Totally. No matter where they are, it doesn't matter. They're just incredible people, old people. They are. I find myself, if I stop long enough, and I stop all the chatter, and I just listen, there is an incredible amount of wisdom, teachings. I have learned so much, you know, as long as I just don't get the judgments in and the prejudices of where they are and everything else. And I have to constantly remind myself not to get caught up in it. And when I really listen and pay attention, I have just walked out of there with wisdom. It's been just incredible, really incredible. I recommend it highly for anybody who needs a little input. You know, just take a tour. Go as a volunteer. It's really an experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have lost something very precious when we lost our extended families. And I think it's in death that one really feels it most strongly. In India, where several of us spend quite a bit of time, the extended family is such a reality. And everybody's called somebody's sister's cousin's brother, and the web is so strong in the villages that we live in that there would be no question of being enough people around to do everything that was needed all the time. And the subtle costs of urbanization and our mobility, these are the costs that we're beginning to sense now. And later we just talk about some of the social changes that are happening in the culture. will. I mean, now, for example, if the statistic is that over 50% of the marriages, like in California, end in divorce, and over 80% of the divorcees remarry, most children have at least now 8 grandparents or 6 grandparents, or they have more than they know quite what to do with, and the whole thing is turning, it's all getting awfully impersonal very quickly. And what it showed in the movie Gramps was how rich the whole process was of, but how rare it was that those young people would choose to buy a home near their grandfather's house. I mean, there you could all feel in yourself how far out that was already. And we have been so, most of us, so quick to get away from home, to push it all away. And now I have a feeling that along with this sensitivity to the issue of dying, this is part and parcel of a change in a consciousness about how to live and how to treasure and respect the richness of relationship. We're going to see another movie one of these nights that is just incredibly powerful about older people. And we'll talk about that more later. It's very interesting when I hear you speak and I talk to many other people who work in nursing homes who are totally drained and destroyed by it because they don't come in with their own joy and respect and love. And they can't hear. It's interesting, in India, the senior member of the family, like in the Sa family, which is the family we were very close to, I.L. Sa, who was the elder, he was about 84, 86. And when any major family decision came up, we went to I.L., and everybody in the family deferred to I.L. And I.L., because he was expected to be that responsible, he retained his consciousness. And we have done something so devastating to people by being really basically a hunting tribe. And the way hunting tribes deal with their elders is they can't afford them because they got to keep moving around all the time, so they send them out to the jungle, out to the woods to die, or they send them to a nursing home or something like that, or to Miami or to Venice or wherever it turns out to be. And because of that, a lot of illnesses occur that wouldn't occur otherwise, of course. So a lot of what we're talking about this week not only has to do with dying, it has to do with the style in which one lives and the decisions, the choices one makes as to how one shares one's time and how one fills one's consciousness and what is valued, where values lie. And this is one of the issues, the relationship to our own extended families. Because I was in a transitional place when I remember my father used to irritate me so much because he used to keep saying, blood is thicker than water. Because I had all these friends who were my lifelong friends. He kept saying, they're all fine, but blood is thicker than water. And it's funny that most of those friends are gone and he's still around. So in some way, I guess he's right. I mean, it's more binding in a certain way because that's your given karma. You don't walk away from given karma without a karma cost, it turns out. That's what we're assessing now, is the karma cost of that. And like with Nancy and her mother, with these mother-daughter teams that are around here, we get a sense of that coming together. And when my father comes to one of my lectures, or I go and hang out with him, there's really a kind of a joy now in after I got over not respecting him because he was so stupid and narrow and old-fashioned and uninteresting and boring and repetitive. And then I got through that and I suddenly found that he was kind of fun and we could really have some good times together, and it blew my mind. They weren't the good times I was used to having, but that was my problem. You know? It's very hard to jump generations. Yes.
They treat the people in the homes like one big family.
Hmm.
They have their own private little quarters with maybe a little portable kitchen thing so that they can fix tea or breakfast for themselves. And then they eat communally the rest of the time. Danes are beer drinkers, so they have beer every night for the people that want it. And if it's a special anniversary or birthday, they have their schnapps with their beer. And the residents plan some of their own meals. They didn't care for some of the things they were serving. They had a chance to plan their own meal because
they
just had no perception of this kind of treatment here in this country.
Mm. I keep finding in convalescent homes many nurses and physiotherapists and doctors who are genuinely humanly concerned and compassionate and good people, but the system in which they work has so few degrees of freedom in which they can play. I'm sure many of you have felt that frustration, and we'll discuss that more when we talk about sort of institutional structures and limits, but there's no shortage of human compassion in this situation. It's merely models that exist as to how it could be, and you're presenting that other model. Just the idea of creating, like many of you are familiar with the one of the projects of the Hanuman Foundation, the Prison Ashram Project, in which it's just a simple thing of presenting another model of how it could be, that a prison is just a place with cells and food and clothing and people and time, and it could be an ashram or a monastery or prison. It depends on whose mind is where about what it is. And the humorous thing I usually say is, imagine a prison cell block with 15 inmates and 3 guards, and the inmates all think they're in an ashram, and the only people left in prison are the guards, it turns out. And it's the same kind of issue, that you can take an institution that's just a set of walls and so on, and just breathe into it through a conspiracy of collaboration. But the predicament is that as we've become more and more of a impersonal society, insurance laws and all kinds of health laws, and, you know, you can't bring your children, like I used to talk with Elizabeth Ross about her battles to allow people that were in intensive care wards to have their children come to visit them because the children weren't sterilized enough to be able to get into the intensive care ward, or they might make too much noise, or they were an inconvenience, let alone bringing somebody's pet cat or a dog in to visit them. And we have a long way to go to... Because when we're anxious, we just revert to physical care. We forget the psychological. We just revert to keep them clean, keep them efficient. We revert to efficiency. That's sort of something that's comfortable for us.
She lived alone, and she was very independent, and we knew that Houston knew that it was possible that she could be killed where she lived, or she could fall down the steps, or she could have a stroke and die alone. And we had talked of all the possibilities, and she just decided she'd rather take the chance and stay by herself. So the time seemed to be coming rather close to when it would have seemed advisable for me to move there and shut up my house and go live with, you know, to sort of be another pair of hands around. But she did have a stroke by herself, and but I was glad. It was good.
Mm. Was she alone when she had the stroke, and what happened then?
Well, she had her system of lights so the neighbors could keep track of her, and we had called this morning, my daughter and I, and there was no answer, and we went down and there was no sound. So, you know, we threw rocks at the window and the whole thing. Finally, made our way through the screen door and went upstairs and gathered her up and called the doctor, and I said, I have always told Mother I'd never take her out of here. and he said, she'll do better in a hospital. So I said, well, you know, what? So we carried her to a hospital. She died that day. But I held her as she died, and that's another reason I'm here. Because I felt very inadequate, you know.
I hear it. Yeah. That's a good story about the respecting her enough to give her the choice to be alone, to have her own stroke. You know, that's just a scary one. That's a real scary one. Most of us just won't give space to another human being that much. You know, we say, don't be irrational.
They were never taken to a hospital. They lived and died at home. And I just never gave it much thought about that. And when my father died, I asked my mother if she wanted to come and live with me, and she said no, she wanted to be alone. And she's now 85. She still lives alone. And she, for example, even broke her leg and insisted on staying home. And for 9 months, she wore a cast. And just prior to that, she said, she lives, oh, this is what I wanted to point out, that there are some possibilities in this country, too. She lives in a large apartment complex that is for no one but senior citizens. And they all have their own kitchens, they make their own food, they take care of themselves, but they have each other. And I had to respect that if she came to live with me, she would have no one, just me. Whereas there, she has a whole community of people that really matter to her. Plus, I got the biggest kick out of this, if you can imagine, a little old Jewish lady who said that there was a man who came and he was talking about that thing that you started a long time ago called meditation. And so I go to his class.
So it's never too late.
That's right. Ramdev teaches meditation in a...
Yeah, I was thinking maybe it's the same place.
I thought that what was going on was the problem of the family interaction. I mean, he got dizzy once when he stood up, but that's hardly senile.
It was the most minimal information.
Unless it did say it was one in a series, so I thought maybe we had missed something.
I don't know.
Film.
Hmm?
That's just an excerpt. It's a full-length movie called I Never Sang for My Father. It's about a 2.5-hour movie.
It's probably because of the history. I mean, when you have a history in the family, it's much more difficult. I moved in as a housekeeper with a retired professor at, I think he was around 85, 86, when I moved in. And he was going to the Gentlemen's Lawn Bowling Association twice a week, quite regularly, until they gave him some medicine that made him sick. And I took care of him. We had this agreement that I would never lie to him. And every night he would sit in his library, and we would have a glass of wine before dinner. And he would say, "Now, listen, I don't want to leave this house, and I just want to die at home." And you know, we had this agreement. So this went on, and then he got sick. And so for a while, I used to carry him downstairs off the front lawn. For a long time, and then he got even so that that was too much for him. So he was in his room, and he blew on a Kaiser. Well, I couldn't get Kaiser out at that time. That was quite a few years ago.
So I had doctor friends, and the neighbor across the street would come over, and they would say, listen, you've got to get him in the hospital. You're going to be sued. I said, by who? God? You know? And they would just come. He said, I'm not coming in this house anymore. He's got to go in the hospital. I said, what are they going to do for him? And I'm not doing. You know, I'm a registered nurse. I mean, what can you do for him? You know? Well, please get a suction machine here. I said, listen, he's been smoking 3 packs of Camels for 56 years. What do you expect me to do? Suck out his lungs now? So it went on and on. And I fought because I didn't exactly like taking care of him 24 hours a day. But I had gotten so attached to him by that time that I couldn't let him go. So then it got to the point where I was really tired. So I was looking for someone to watch him, so I go down to Carmel. And he was always very right on all the time. So I found this man. This guy was a German professor, right? And I found this guy named Sasha. And Sasha said, of course I'll take care of him. It's no bother to me. I said, yeah, but you have to clean him up and things like that. It doesn't matter to me. I can take care of him. So I said, okay. I think he'll like it because, you know, you can speak to him and you've seen him and stuff like that. So the night before I was to leave for Carmel, he had a little bell in his room that I had given him, and he rang the bell. So I scurry in, and, yes, Lawrence? Why are you the only one that can hear me? What do you mean? I said. He said, well, Phyllis is right over there in the corner, and I holler, Phyllis! Phyllis! But she doesn't answer me. Phyllis was his daughter that came to see him once a year. I said, well, Lawrence, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, and Phyllis is home in bed. And I'm going down to get you some hot chocolate. Do you want anything else? Not unless you have any apparition pills, he said. So I said, okay, I don't have any of those. And so the next morning, Sasha comes. And I said, well, Lawrence, how do you feel? Is it okay if I go to Carmel? Yes, it's fine. Well, here, Sasha's here. I'm going to go to Carmel. I'll be back in a couple of days. Well, let me give you a kiss goodbye then. Okay. Puts his arms around me, holds on for a long time. He said, you know, this was a very stoic man. He was an atheist, staunch atheist, and he also was completely unemotional. He would never say anything. He said, spent quite a bit of time telling me he loved me. And so I left, and I went and got in the car, and I drove down to Carmel. I got down to Carmel, and Sasha said we went back upstairs, and he was gone before I got down there. And that was a really wonderful experience for me, and my daughter enjoyed the whole experience, too. But right before I came to this retreat, I called my mother in San Diego. There comes the history, you see. My mother's an alcoholic, and I took care of her for a long time, and finally I voiced her off on my sister in San Diego. And now my sister has moved to Texas, and the family's left me with the short end of the straw again. They did the... That's awful. We got together at this last family gathering, and they said, well, your daughter's growing up now, and you know, you're going to have to be the one. So I called up Roberta. I've never called her anything but Roberta, and said, well, I'm going to this retreat now, and I was thinking about coming to see you. And she said, oh, I'm so glad, because I'm going to the hospital today. And I said, what? And she said, well, I have this hiatus hernia. And she said, could you come before you go to the retreat? And I said, well, I'll give you the number, and if you have to call me, you can call me. And I haven't called her, and I'm sitting here every day, and now I know why I still feel so miserable. It's because that one's impossible for me to handle. I can take care of the whole world, but I don't want to go there. With a passion, you know, I can't see how I could possibly do it, you know. And yet I'm going to, because if I didn't, I'd... My God, I'd die of guilt. I mean, I would just right on the spot. I mean, God would strike me dead.
Yeah.
If I didn't go.
Nobody else can go. One's got a baby, one's in Texas, one's here, one's there.
Mm.
But I can't think of a thing that I can't find any compassion in my heart for. I can't, she's been totally selfish her whole life. I can't remember a kind thing she's ever said or done for me. You know, not one thing. And it's not going to be any fun. And if there's a phone call for me, would you tell her I'm going to the desert? So if anyone wants to take care of somebody else, it's so much easier than
trade off parents.
Family.
I know other people here who have mothers that they would trade off in a minute. Saint training, Jude, is not easy.
But I'll train. Yeah.
Would you say that all again a little slower? You talk very fast, and it's hard to hear a word you say.
Stuck in the film, and I've been struck before by the karma. You know, you can really see karma in something like that, because, you know, the first film, the guy really was reaping what he sowed. He'd sowed those relationships. You could just see it. And your mother is, you know, at least the way I see it, has sowed whatever feelings you have for her. And the other relationship, it wasn't just that the family was so wonderful. They loved him because that's what he'd sowed. You know, he'd done it, and he
mm-hmm.
gets it back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
The tough passage.
But as we get on with our work in this week and deal with the spiritual processes in ourselves, we understand that your mother has sowed her seeds, but whether you buy them or not is your karmic predicament. And this becomes just an interesting exercise. It may be too hot a fire for you at this moment, and there is nothing wrong, as I say again and again, of retreating to fight another day. You know, you may want to go to work somewhere else to hire somebody to take care of her, because it's not psychologically the space you can convert. Because if you can't convert it, there's no sense in getting sucked under in it. A lot of people just feel so much guilt, they just go in and under and under and under, and there's no reason for that at all. But you may see it as a useful spiritual exercise. If you don't, it may well be worth your continuing on with your nursing work to get the money to have somebody, because you can't do that. I think we have to realize our limitations, our psychological limitations. There's no sense in making believe you're holy and then ending up destroying yourself and everyone else along the way.